The Guardian. Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Hugh Muir. If the Liberal Democrats set out this year to dominate the political agenda, well, they've certainly done that. Party grandee Lord Renard was suspended after a week of claim, counterclaim and nightmare headlines. Will there be civil war in the run-up to the election? Also this week, a dramatic dip in unemployment. So is a rise in interest rates just around the corner. Plus, liberalism is dead. Long live post-liberalism. Is it time for a new ideology? Stay tuned, find out. Joining me for all of this is David Goodhart, the director of the think tank Demos, and The Guardian columnist Martin Kettle and Polly Toynbee. Welcome to all of you. Let's start with the Lib Dems. Lord Renard may have caused distress to at least 10 women and ought to apologise, according to an internal report. But it concluded that there was insufficient evidence to bring disciplinary charges, and apologise he will not. Renard says he hasn't anything to say sorry for, fears that doing so will cause him to be sued, and for good measure says he's considering legal action of his own, all of which has left Nick Clegg struggling to stay ahead of the story and taking political hits from almost everywhere. Polly, another fine mess, I suppose, and one of Renard's supporters helpfully put it, he's not Jimmy Savile, and it was just a bit of knee-touching. A fuss about nothing, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think that if you get 10 women saying somebody is a serial toucher-upper and he is a person of immense power, it's quite hard for people outside the Liberal Democrats to imagine that anybody in there has immense power, but he does, did. And he did have power to help people towards target seats and promotion within the party. He was highly influential. And I think when you look at somebody in that kind of position in any office situation, not just politics, politics is no different to anywhere else really in this respect. These days, most canny HR departments move in very quickly, discipline somebody, make them apologise, sit them down, maybe put them through a one-day course in appropriate behaviour. All of those things the Lib Dems should have done instantly. It was years ago this first started. And had they immediately taken action, I don't think these women would have pursued it. I don't think they've got a vendetta. But they simply got kind of zero response. And what's more, a kickback from the House of Lords, who all said they were on his side.
Of course, as we said, Nick Clegg's getting it from all over the place. How could he have dealt with this properly? People say he didn't grip it. How could he have gripped it?
Well, I think right from the early reports, you call everybody in and you do exactly that with Renard. You get somebody to give him a good talking to and then you put him down with those women, let them say what they felt, let him reply, let him say, I didn't mean to cause any offence and of course I won't do this again and I didn't mean to intimidate anyone, I didn't mean to threaten anyone in any way and I do understand my behaviour was inappropriate. And I think that would have been the end of the matter. You know, these things are very difficult, but most organisations these days, large organisations, are very aware and jump very quickly if they get any kind of report. Otherwise, they get very expensive employment tribunal cases.
David Goodhart, do you think this has any resonance? Do you think that people are looking at this and thinking, well, that means I really can't trust the Lib Dems?
Well, no, I think on the contrary. I think they've sort of done us all a service in a way. I mean, they're having a public discussion about something that is very germane in the, you know, in the homes and offices up and down the country.
They're struggling with it as the public are struggling with it. Do you think the public sees it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we live in a very liberal society with shifting values. You know, what is appropriate behaviour is not at all clear in many circumstances, particularly across generations. We also have no consistent measure of harm. I mean, you might say in some senses, it's absolutely ridiculous that this has been front page news when sort of Syria is blowing up or whatever. On the other hand, these are also important issues, and because they're a political party, this is happening in public.
And if the wider subtext is about abuse of power, then that is important, isn't it?
Yeah, although I think it's led to all sorts of sort of hyperbole. I mean, Suzanne Moore saying Lib Dems don't take women seriously, this sort of proves it. I mean, I just don't think that's true at all.
It has been historically true. There are remarkably few women candidates in winnable seats. Of the very few MPs they've got, most of them four out of five are in very precarious seats, surrounding the leaders past and present, not many leading women figures.
And they're very, very bad on representation of minorities too. But to say from that that they don't take women seriously or they don't take minorities seriously is just a sort of logical leap that is not justifiable, I think.
Martin Kettle, is there an argument that one of the reasons that the Lib Dems haven't quite gripped this properly is that Renard is just too important? I mean, he's been their election mastermind. He's said to have done that very well. And maybe they just can't lose him.
I think there's a bit of that. Polly's absolutely right. Chris Renard is a very, very big fish in a relatively small, until recently, small pond. And he was the go-to person who ran that party and was deemed to be the organizer of victory when they had victories. So, he was influential and still is. I think also there is a problem that the Lib Dems take a rather, what they would see as a rather sort of high-minded attitude against positive discrimination. And so, because that's, I think Polly wrote this the other day, actually. I mean, because they have, rather dug their heels in against positive discrimination, unlike the other two major parties, that's given disproportionate power, arguably, to the man at the centre who is very influential about selecting candidates. I mean, in one sense, it's a huge fuss about a relatively small, but within its own context, important row. I think it is actually quite important politically because, looking ahead to the election, the battleground between the Liberal Democrats and Labour for voters on the left is pretty crucial battleground. This is not good for those libertarian. This is not a good sign from the Liberal Democrat point of view for those libertarian voters, especially women libertarian voters, who in the past have been tended to support the Lib Dems. This is not, this is like saying, we're shutting the door.
And Labour is miles ahead amongst women. If there were only women voters, Labour would win streets ahead.
Yes, that's the biggest sociological political change in our lifetime.
Polly, it's part of the problem that they saddle themselves with a structure that means that Nick Clegg actually can't dictate to Lord Renard very easily and maybe didn't have the tools to sort this out.
They have a very peculiar patchwork structure which has sort of grown up by accretion over the years. It is in a way very democratic, but in the end kind of not democratic because nobody really has any final say over anything. And I think it's very confusing when you're the party of government and you can't actually say what should happen when there's an emergency like this blows up.
Hugh, they're also the lawyers' party, and I think they made a big mistake in having this kind of an inquiry, go to a QC, have everybody talking to the QCs, of whom there is a disproportionate number amongst senior Liberal Democrats. This was a bad that was a bad way to go. It would have been much better to have gone down some kind of workplace process where you bring people together, you get it right from the start, you compel Renard to buy into the solution to the process by taking part in it, and everybody will learn their lessons, etc., etc., and everybody will try to do better next time. That would have been a far more effective way of dealing with it. But because they're a bit kind of in awe of QCs, they went down that route, and they're into a real tangle.
I got into trouble for pointing out that he's a rather portly elderly gentleman, and these were younger, more attractive women, and the only possible way he could have thought to try his hands would have been to do with power. I had huge blowback from readers saying, "How dare you comment on his physical appearance?" But actually, it is a part of the story.
How?
I can't imagine me putting my hand on George Clooney's knee. You kind of know your level, and if somebody is in a position of power, breathing heavily on younger, more attractive junior women within their organisation, that is a part of the story too.
But if he'd been a top-looking bloke also abusing his position, that would have been pretty serious as well, wouldn't it?
Bill Clinton and QV.
Yeah, but on the other hand, it's slightly more. You think, well, the slightly more equality there. I mean, there's equality comes in all sorts of things, not just about power, but also about physical attractiveness too.
Ironically, doesn't this make the case for sort of thick of it fixers and spinmeisters, that actually, you know, the two big parties have, you know, are perhaps overfull of such people, but they see these things coming and they snuff them out. The Lib Dems are suffering from not having enough of a thick of it culture.
You can't snuff it out. You have to actually have it out openly. If it's 10 women, you actually have to be quite open and transparent about it. You can't just shut them up.
But David's right, though. I mean, Alistair Campbell wouldn't have let this go on 24 hours, never mind 24 days, as it's beginning to.
And it continues to go on because, of course, we now have this separate independent investigation into coming into the public domain involving the Lib Dem MP in Portsmouth, Mike Hancock, and that found credible evidence of sexual harassment against a constituent there. Polly, they do get to a point where people start saying, and this is happening again, this must mean something about your party and the behaviour and the values of your party.
This looks like a rather more serious case, really, and a rather more vulnerable person involved. Yes, I mean, this happens in all kinds of organisations and, of course, all across political parties. You know, I can remember more than one Labour cabinet minister behaving very inappropriately with his office staff and women having to be protected. And it's the nature of power in office structures, hierarchical structures. So we shouldn't get carried away with the idea that it's just one party, or even certainly that it's just politics. In fact, probably slightly less in politics, because they're all a bit more aware of the vulnerability of their reputation. Though you think about, I don't know, the risk that John Major took with Edwina Curry, and you wonder.
So, Lib Dems today, but who knows who tomorrow. But let's leave that there for now and move on to a good news story for the British economy. Unemployment took another sharp dip this week as more workers found full-time and part-time jobs across the country. Martin, I said good news. Will Labour see it that way? And, of course, the forecasters at the Bank of England are now saying they may raise interest rates if unemployment dips any further. That might not be such good news.
Well, you can say it's all relative, and of course it is all relative, and unemployment is still pretty high by historic measures, and long-term unemployment is still very high by historic measures, and youth unemployment is particularly difficult in some parts of the country. So, you know, but all that said, don't let's delude ourselves. Politically, this is fantastically good news for the coalition, and particularly for the Tories, because it absolutely bolts in their argument that they've, you know, delivered the tough medicine. You know, it's been tough, but we've taken the right decisions, and it definitely gives them the sense that they've got to, that, you know, that they can go into the election as the custodians of growth, and, you know, don't put it at risk with the other guy. You know, that said, I think all the signs are that interest rates are not going to be raised anytime terribly soon, and there'll be a lot of political influence at work in that. And, you know, it should also be said that this is, you know, of a pattern with other economies in the Western world, not all recovering at the rate that the UK is, but you know, there is an upward trend going on generally. So, you know, of course, it's good news politically for the government, and you know, however we try to unpick it and deconstruct it and, you know, put it back together again as a terrible thing. I think we have to recognise that we're dealing with a pretty major development here in terms of the politics, whether it's a major change to the economic position of ordinary people in this country over the long term is another matter altogether.
Polly, how does Labour best deal with this? They were talking about the concept of real wages in PMQs yesterday, but that's a tough subtlety to get across in the bare pit of the Commons, isn't it?
I think it all depends in the end how people actually feel by the time we get to the election. And it's still not clear. Probably wages may have started to overtake inflation. But that still doesn't catch people up nearly to how much they've lost over the last few years. Will they actually be feeling better in 16 months' time? that's the big dilemma. Of course, the employment figures are terrifically good news for the government, and there's no doubt about it. Even though underneath that, you know, 1 million public sector jobs will have been lost. Good jobs with holiday, with proper pay, with pensions, exchanged for very often much lower paying jobs, and a lot of them pretty rotten in terms of their conditions. You know, nearly 1 million young people unemployed, youth long-term unemployed, still pretty scary. So the question is whether people feel better by the next election because they believe in all these figures and it's all going upward and don't let Labour spoil it, or whether actually in their own pockets they know life is still very hard. And on the interest rates, I'm willing to eat any number of hats that Mark Carney will not raise interest rates before the next election. And if Labour wins the election, that's the first thing that'll land on their plate. Jolly nasty it'll be for them too. So, you know, the idea of the Bank of England isn't political. It's highly political. And it's full of political people. And Mark Carney was not put there in order by George Osborne begging him to take the job in order to clobber him just before the election.
David, do you think this stuff works when the government or when George Osborne says things are getting better? Does that resonate with people? Do people feel that, or is there a time lag, do you think?
I don't think people are listening particularly. I mean, I think as long as you don't sort of tip over into sort of you've never had it so good language, I think it's fine. I mean, obviously it is reasonably good news economically.
That's the problem, isn't it? They don't trust journalists, so if they read about the good news in a newspaper, then they won't believe that, and they don't trust politicians either. So
no, but I mean, they do trust their own experience, and you know, assuming it is true, they're not fixing the figures, then they will know somebody who knows somebody who's just got a job, or you know, who's been unemployed for a while. But as Polly says, I think this is doing nothing to change the structure of the labour market or indeed the economy. We have this hourglass economy. We've had it for a couple of decades. It's got worse. It got worse under Labour. It's continuing to in that hourglass form now. But by which I mean about 40% of the jobs in the economy are highly productive, usually pretty well paid, and pretty skilled. Now, that includes everything from, you know, working on the production line at Nissan in Sunderland to being a city lawyer. You've got some jobs in the middle, many of them in the public services, and then you've got a huge tail, a huge bottom part of the hourglass of 7 to 8 million private sector service jobs in care, in retail, cleaning and so on, which are all being paid at, you know, £8 an hour or less, considerably less in many cases. And I think something like 80% of the jobs that have been created since 2010 are at £8 an hour or less. You know, this is just reinforcing the hourglass. Yeah. Now, these are all long-term structural things that you can't expect, you know, chances to easily deal with over a year or two. But we seem to have sort of given up, really, on trying to do anything about it.
Martin, how close to the election do you think people, at what point do you think people will have to start feeling better for it to impact on the election?
Well, I think that you can already see some of it. I mean, I think that if you look at people's economic expectations, which the pollsters are doing all the time, they have improved. They've improved over the last few months. I'm sure they will go on improving. And in one sense, they'll be absolutely right to improve. So in that sense, I think it is impacting on the election. I think if you look at the state of the polls between the parties at the moment, what's surprising and interesting, and I think worries the Conservatives in particular, is that they feel they ought to be getting more of an electoral dividend, more of a poll dividend from the economic news that has been going on really now for about 6 months and is accelerating. And there's not an awful lot of sign of that. I mean, the Labour lead on average is a bit down from what it was a year ago, but it's still there. It's still pretty resilient. And Tories are worried about that. And so, you know, that is there's something else that from the Tory point of view that they're going to have to come up with in order to be really match ready by the time we get to the election in 16 months' time. You know, he pays your money and he takes your choice as to what those other things are. The obvious subjects around are immigration and welfare, and whether or not, I've written about this morning, get a little plug for my column, you know, how they play the Miliband question. But I think it's somewhere in there that Linton Crosby and George Osborne are talking about, you know, how they can manage to get up from the low 30s towards the upper 30s, which the Tories unquestionably will need to do in order to be the largest single party, never mind win the election.
The Tories are often the victim of reading their own newspapers, that they see immigration and welfare cuts as the big issue, because that's what the newspapers go on about, and certainly people feel very strongly about. What they don't see, because it doesn't get written about so much, is the extent to which their cuts have hit ordinary working families, tax credits and lots of other cuts. People really know that their incomes have been deliberately cut, particularly families with children have suffered, the freeze in the child benefit, let alone the people higher up the scale losing it altogether. So this whole question of Labour doing well amongst women is because they know how much their own benefits of ordinary working families, we're not talking about Benefit Street people, have been hit. And this government doesn't factor there in. They think they've got away with it, and they probably haven't.
OK, well, we've talked about perception and reality. Let's talk about some of the ideas underpinning our politics, because as the aftermath of the 2008 crash appears to ease, new political ideas have been slow in catching up with the new reality that faces us. And David, you've written an essay, a recent essay, about post-liberalism, and set that out in that essay. Set it out for us. What is it?
Yeah, this idea has been around for a while. You might say it's an old combination of ideas in new clothing. I'm quite sympathetic to the ideas that I categorise as post-liberal, and I was trying in this essay in the new issue of Demos Quarterly to sort of delineate what it is, and also perhaps try and separate it out somewhat from the Blue Labour strand, and indeed the Red Tory strand, which has perhaps been the best known exemplars of something that one might call post-liberal. In very, very loose terms, I think post-liberalism is building on, I mean, we've been dominated by the double liberalism of economic liberalism and social cultural liberalism now for the last 20 years or so. There's a pretty broad consensus, and post-liberalism shares much of that. It sees itself as sort of building on what is good and successful in those two liberalisms that have dominated politics, but looking at the failings and the silences and the unintended consequences of both of them. I think it's probably, I come from the centre-left, I think it's something that's easier in some ways it's easier for people in opposition to think about these things, and I think it is easier for the centre-left to take up some of these ideas, because it's premised on a traditional, if you like, social democratic critique of economic liberalism. But where it's difficult for some of the centre-left is that it's also critical of some aspects of social and cultural liberalism. You know, it's wary of the stress on freedom from, on the stress on autonomy, the implicit, universalism, the universalism stroke individualism that is still, I think, a sort of deeply embedded in thinking on the centre-left. Three points that I think post-liberalism would stress against sort of conventional liberalism, the conventional liberalisms. One is, post-liberalism believes in human equality, as we all do, but it also is aware of people's moral particularism. People have a kind of hierarchy of obligation, and I think often that isn't taken sufficient account of by traditional social and cultural liberalism. I mean, to give a very silly example, in a way, we spend about 30 times more every year on the NHS than we do on development aid. I mean, that which is a symbol of our moral particularism in a way. But if you're a true universalist, you should think that that is a kind of crime. On welfare, the welfare state has sort of shifted gradually, not only away from contribution, but sort of towards need. Now, obviously, a welfare state should respond to need, but in so doing, all sorts of social developments have pushed it in this direction. We downplay contribution, we downplay sort of community and social housing and so on. And I think another thing, which we've actually already touched on, that post-liberalism would place a special stress on, is the hourglass economy. And the whole question is not just of income inequality that we do talk about a lot, but inequalities of prestige and status and esteem, which I think are hugely important in our society. and we need to worry about more. I mean, I think the language of meritocracy and social mobility that the whole political class worries about is far too narrow. I mean, it's essentially successful people saying you should all be like me. And I think we need a big injection of kind of Michael Young thinking, which is that society, you know, good society is not just about mobility and ladders out and up. It's about circles of mutual dependency. Of course, we want the cleverest people in the top jobs. We want the right people in the right jobs. But everybody is making a contribution. We simply do not value any longer, or we value only in economic terms, the contribution that people make. And I think the average voter, would find these ideas attractive. They cross party lines to some extent, although I think the centre-left has greater use for them in a way. It's a kind of liberal communitarianism, which I think is probably where most voters are. And there isn't a party yet that has sort of, I think there's a hidden majority there that a party could grab.
Okay, well, that's your stall set out. Polly, what's your take on that?
I think it's very interesting. You're absolutely right about this question of esteem. There's not much governments can do about the hourglass economy. That's the trouble, because this is kind of structural and about the nature of automation and the huge growth of demand for service jobs at one hand and for very high-skilled professional at the other, and the hollowing out of, you know, sort of middle-level jobs in offices and that kind of thing. But what the government can do is to raise the esteem of the people at the bottom. And I think that it does go together with money. Money isn't the only thing, but if you look at traditional Nordic countries, there you have a situation where the hospital consultant will live in the same street as the hospital cleaner, the kids go to the same school, they'll have more or less the same holiday and drive more or less the same car because their incomes are not that far apart. The penalty for falling down the ladder for the child of the doctor, not that great. The difficulty of climbing up the ladder, not very difficult because it's short and flat. And that's the kind of society where you then do esteem the people at the bottom more, because they're not all that different in lifestyle. And that's about money. And in the end, all that governments can really do is to push hard on the money front and talk about esteem.
Martin, is David right? Have we run out of road with the current model? Do we really need this rethink now?
I think it's unquestionable that the old politics is bankrupt in many respects. I mean, the old industrial class politics of the mid-20th century is not going to come back. And anybody who spends their political life trying to reconstruct it is wasting their time, and they're doomed to failure, it seems to me. You can keep a viable Labour Party going, you can keep a viable Conservative Party going, but what you can't do, I think, now is reconstruct a Labour majority or a Conservative majority based on those kind of politics of the mid-20th century. It's not going to happen, and those who are doing it are just, you know, they're kind of wasting their and our time. I think David's definitely onto something significant and worthy. I've always taken the view, which I know some people haven't, that his writing, you know, is a good contribution, which ought to be part of the debate about the kind of evolution of a modern society. And so, I welcome what he's written. I think it's good stuff. What strikes me about it in the particular where we are now is that it fits very well to what I sense Ed Miliband's project is. You know, I think Ed Miliband is more or less in the same bit of territory intellectually and politically as David is sketching out. And I think I would also argue that the Liberal Democrats are somewhere in there too. But I don't think the Conservative Party is anywhere close to that, because I think the Conservative Party and also UKIP are obsessed with the legacy of Mrs. Thatcher, and they remain in thrall to the possessive individualism of the Thatcher era, plus the sort of post-imperial delusion of the Thatcher era. Now, I'm not saying everything about the Thatcher era was wrong, and I'm not saying, you know, that if only history had stopped in 1979, we would be in a, you know, in the country of my dreams or Polly's dreams, because we wouldn't be. But I think there is a real absence of a serious conservative project at the moment. And, you know, that's part of Cameron's tragedy to me, is that he is not he was quite close to some of the things that David's talking about. And of course, the big society is in some ways the best known example of that. He was in there. He was in that debate. But at the moment, he's not. And the
but
Tory Party
pretense.
Really,
it was pretense. Well, the whole lot was stripped away from the moment they came in. The moment that they came in. The moment with from the first of the NHS Act, from their education policies, the things that they hit the ground running with. It was quite clear that he never meant it when he said, you know, about everything he'd said about the NHS beforehand. I think the Conservatives have a very clear project, but I think it's destined to fail politically because it's just they're not going to get enough traction for it. If you look at the Free Enterprise Group, you look at the young Conservative MPs, the class of 2010, they are passionately pro-market. They simply think that nothing works unless the market guides it, that anything that the dead hand of the state puts its finger on is destined to disaster of one kind or another. They believe it fully, absolutely and passionately. And I don't think that most of the people believe it about most things most of the time. People have a more nuanced view than that.
David Goodhart?
Well, I mean, I think one thing that Martin misses out in saying this is... I mean, I agree that this is easier for Labour to take up, but I think it's also very difficult for Labour to take up some of it. I mean, if you look at the what one might call the security and identity issues in immigration, multiculturalism, welfare, national sovereignty, on all of those issues, whatever you say about the Conservative Party, they are miles closer to the ordinary voter than the Labour Party is. I mean, the Labour Party has been sort of nudging, you know, in a somewhat more post-liberal direction on many of these policies, but it's sort of not, it's not believed in some. I mean, I remember John Denham saying this at an event we did at the Labour Party conference, that it's sort of paying lip service to some of these things. It understands this huge gap that there is between its own instincts and the instincts of the ordinary voter, and it knows it has to close them, but it can't sort of emotionally occupy, you know, an immigration cap or indeed a welfare cap. I mean, these are enormously popular policies, and certainly on the immigration story, I don't think the government has been doing too badly. It's been slightly thrown by the increase in EU immigration in the last few months, but it had actually been making quite a lot of progress. The welfare thing is more complicated because of the whole universal credit sort of technology screw up. But I mean, these are enormously popular policies, and I don't think Labour is yet coming up with sort of sufficiently worked out sort of post-liberal policies on them in a way. It's got to move closer to the public if it wants to have credibility, and this is Labour's Achilles heel.
Supported everything the government's done on immigration. It hasn't
that's true.
It.
But it hasn't sort of, yeah, I mean, but it sort of missed an opportunity in some ways to come up with sort of something of its own that may, you know, it complains about the cap being sort of irrational. Well, come up with a rational one of your own, and it hasn't done that.
Well, maybe what you have here is the way forward. Have the parties read the essay and been in touch? Does anyone want to claim this as their blueprint?
Well, I commissioned various people to do various short responses, and I got a pretty positive response from John Crudders, which fits with what Martin was saying about the popularity of some of this thinking on around Ed Miliband at the top of the Labour Party. But I also got a very favourable response from David Willetts, who was, of course, claiming it for conservatism, but which I think he's wrong to do. But there is a cross-party appeal there, I think.
Well, the Conservative Party was David Willetts would be another place.
Ah, we all agree about that.
Well, we'll look at what they do and see if we can detect you as the guiding hand behind it. But that's all we have time for now. My thanks to David Goodhart, Polly Toynbee and Martin Kettle. Keep up with matters political on theguardian.com/politics. The producer of this podcast was Phil Maynard. I'm Hugh Muir. Thank you for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 10% off.